Gareth Tyndall, and he teaches at a uni school. Sometimes the boys ask him, "Sir, have you got a brother called Mike?" And his response is, "Yes, I have a brother called Mike." Well, it's not the Mike Tyndall who plays rugby for England, or who was in a relationship with Zara Phillips, but he has come from America this last few days to stay in London, and my wife and I are going down to see him tonight. So we will be leaving you rather quickly, if that's all right, after the evening service, to travel down to South London to see our son. We're going to look tonight at 1 Corinthians chapter 4, and particularly, but not exclusively, at verse 9, for I think that God has displayed us, the apostles, last, as men condemned to death, for we have been made a spectacle to the world, both to angels and to men. And if you look in the margin, have you got margins in your church Bibles? No, okay. Well, don't bother looking in the margin then. 2 years ago, at about 12 o'clock on the 8th of December, a procession began which was called the Sweet Chariot Victory Parade. I think it was a long time ago now. It was organized by the team sponsors, O2. And it began at Marble Arch, it proceeded down Oxford Street, it turned right into Regent Street, and the English, successful English rugby team were travelling on the top of two open topped buses. The buses travelled down the Haymarket and reached Trafalgar Square. And there were thousands upon thousands of people lining the streets. The Metropolitan Police had closed off almost the whole of central London. And the event culminated in an audience with the Queen at Buckingham Palace and with a reception with the Prime Minister at No. 10 Downing Street. It was what you might call a triumphal procession. Well, we don't win much at the international level as a country, so I suppose you have to make the most of these things when they do happen. Well, familiar, I think, with that kind of thing. We want to give recognition, do we not, to our heroes, whether they're war heroes or sporting heroes, men and women who brought glory to our nation. And I think we tend to want to do this all the more today because we're living in an age that enjoys celebrity. It doesn't really matter really what kind of character people have. We're interested in them if they are celebrities. And a lot of our TV programs are celebrity TV programs. We want to know all the little details of their lives, even if actually their lives are more boring than your Auntie Ethel's second cousin. We want to know all the little details of their lives. I visit the dentist from time to time, once every 6 months, and it's my opportunity to read Hello magazine. And it's about celebrity. A young lady in front of me on the 35 bus in Birmingham recently was reading her magazine and she left it on the seat. I picked it up to have a look and it was the latest celebrity magazine. I couldn't remember now what it was called, but it was all about important and famous people. I remember some years ago on Parkinson, Victoria Beckham spoke about what it was like to be virtually imprisoned with her two children in a Spanish hotel room. And on one occasion she said she found herself screaming at her son Brooklyn because he was about to go out on the balcony of the hotel to get a bit of fresh air. And she screamed at him because she knew that the paparazzi were waiting outside to photograph her son and send these photographs all around the world for whoever, whatever perverts might want to look at them. And I know several celebrities who refuse to let the pictures of their children be seen in public in case they are abused. The paparazzi are even rumoured, I think it's fact, took pictures of a dying Princess Diana as she lay bleeding in a smashed Mercedes in Paris. Why? Because of our insatiable appetite for celebrity. So I'm beginning this way because I'd like to reflect on 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 9. The Greek city of Corinth, to which the church in Corinth, was the one to which this letter was written, was not unlike modern London. The cult of celebrity was huge in Greek culture, and the instinct to indulge in personal propaganda by the celebrities was massive. Their philosophy was, if you've got it, flaunt it. There were public performers, orators, in Corinth who could draw crowds of thousands of people, and they were incredible celebrities. They wore outlandish clothes to try and outdo one another in the public eye. They were very famous. People would say, well, I think he's the best, or somebody would say, I think the other one's the best, and they would engage in contests against each other in the hope that crowds would shout out their name. And you find a little echo of that here in 1 Corinthians 4, in 1 Corinthians 3, look at the end of 1 Corinthians 3, and he says, let no one boast in men, for all things are yours, whether Paul or Apollos or Cephas or the world or life to come. And there were people in Corinth who were saying, well, I favor Paul, another, I favor Apollos, I favor Cephas, I favor Christ. There was a kind of celebrity competition going on in the life of the church, because the culture of the world, the celebrity culture of the world in Corinth, had invaded the church. And there was this horrible thing going on. And one writer says, the Corinthians placed a high premium on social prominence and self-display, on personal power and boasting. It was a place where assertiveness and pride reaped a great reward. And this spirit, therefore, had invaded the church. And there were new church leaders here in this church who were making a lot of their celebrity status. And they were boastful men. And they were so filled with a sense of their own importance and their own spirituality and their own giftedness that people were beginning to think that the Apostle Paul was a bit of a nobody. The man who planted the church, the man who'd been responsible under God for many of their conversions, was now being regarded in the church at Corinth as a has-been. They're beginning to look down on their apostle. They said things like, his speech is contemptible. He's not much of a preacher. His speech is contemptible. They said his presence is weak. When you're in the presence of the Apostle Paul, it doesn't make an impact on you. He's a bit of a nobody. He could walk into a room and nobody would notice him. It's terrible when people don't remember you, isn't it? And you say, well, I met you at Taster. And I spent the evening with you, and they say, I'm sorry, what's your name again? I get that all the time. I have come to the conclusion over the 64 years of my life that I have an instantly forgettable face. Because people say, have I met you before? And I say, yes, we went to the Leicester Ministers Conference 25 years together, following year after year. And so it goes on. Well, that was happening to the Apostle Paul. He wasn't much to look at, and he wasn't much to listen to. And Paul spends a lot of time in these letters defending his apostleship. Not because he wants to impress people with himself, not because he wants to defend himself, but because he wants to defend the gospel. And if you were to read through the 1 and 2 Corinthians and make a note of the verses that use the word boasting, it's an interesting exercise. He's quite content. He's not boasting about himself. He's not trying to defend his reputation. In fact, he's quite content to leave his personal status in the hands of God. Look at verse 4. For I know of nothing against myself, yet I am not justified by this, but he who judges me is the Lord. So I'm content to leave my status, my reputation, to the last day. But when he's tackling these issues head on, it's for the gospel's sake. It's for the Corinthians' sake. Because something is happening in the church in Corinth that was undermining the very heart and the very spirit of the gospel. These Corinthians have swallowed a false view of power and weakness. And that is something that is contravening the very spirit and heart of the gospel of Jesus Christ. They swallowed the world's attitudes to celebrity and success, And Paul reckons that they're on their way to ruining their Christian testimony and usefulness unless they come to a better heart. Now you see some evidence of this cross Corinthian spirit in verses 6 to 8. Now these things, brethren, I have figuratively conferred to myself and Apollos for your sakes, that you may learn in us not to think beyond what is written, that none of you may be puffed up on behalf of one against the other. For what makes you differ from one another? What makes any one of you better than the other? And what do you have that you did not receive? Why are you boasting about things as if you earned them or as if you produced them? But actually, they were all gifts of God. So why are you boasting about these things? And then he says in a very ironical way, in verse 8, you are already full, are you? You're already rich. You've reigned as kings without us. And indeed, I could wish you did reign. See, he's saying, you Corinthians, you're walking about your Christian life as though you were kings. Important people with big egos. You're walking about the world as if you were kings with celebrities. And what these people were doing was they were sitting enthroned on their egotistical thrones, and they were looking down upon the Apostle Paul and saying, look at him, his speech is contemptible, his presence is weak. And Paul's not worried about his own reputation. What he's worried about is this boastful, self-exalting spirit that was going to pervade the church at Corinth. And people were walking through the world and in the Christian churches, thought they were kings who could look down on other people and make judgments about them. And listen to Paul's irony. Have you become kings while we are nobodies? Have you become kings while we are nobodies? That's a horrible spirit because it's the exact opposite of the spirit of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And I am persuaded that this Corinthian spirit is invading the life of the Christian church right throughout this nation. It's coming in from the world. We love our Christian celebrities. You know, I wonder sometimes why I go to church after church, and in every church, the front row is empty. Always empty. The church in Chessington, front row was empty. The church at Moneyhole is empty. The front row is empty. The front row at the Lower Ford Street Baptist Church is empty. And yet when I go to a Christian conference where there is a celebrity preacher, the front row is full half an hour before the meeting starts. Why is that? So that people can get a better sight, a better hearing. Why don't they sit at the back like they do at my church? Why? What's Don Carson got that I haven't got? Celebrity. Just a silly example of these things. But there are people in every Christian fellowship, there's probably one here or more, who assume the status of a king. They're usually the people in the weakest spiritual condition. They feel that they have a superior ability to look down on other people and make judgments about them. They're usually the people who stuff a critical letter through the door of the pastor at 10 o'clock on a Sunday night after he's preached his heart out all day, and then he's awake all night because he's just got this letter pushed through the door from someone who condemns him and his whole congregation and his whole ministry. There's a king in almost every Christian congregation. And what they do is they come in, they are enthusiastic for a while, and then they get judgmental, and then begin to say, well, find all the things that are wrong with this church that actually has quite a lot of gifted and godly and humble people in it. They find all the things that are wrong with it, and then they turn their back on the church, and they walk out with their kingly stride, and they go to act as kings in another church, some other blessed church in Coventry. And they are so boastful about themselves that they feel they can sit on their judgment throne and look down upon a congregation of God's people. Isn't it amazing, don't you think, that a professing Christian should feel such a status just to gather up a whole church and consign it to the rubbish bin of their opinion? Paul, his speech is contemptible. presence is weak. It's one of the most stunning and alarming features of the Christian spirit, the Corinthian spirit, that it can do this without hardly batting an eyelid. And it usually begins in the hearts of people who begin to use the word them. They don't talk about us anymore, us at Lower Fourth Street. They talk about those people up there, or them. They're such an unloving group, those people. This is kingly spirit. Surely, if we're such nobodies, says Paul, really, you must be a real somebody. If you can talk about me as if I'm a nobody, that must make you a somebody in order to have the status to look down on the rest of us. Have you become kings? Well, we are still nobodies. Now, there may be someone here tonight who's actually got quite a critical spirit. You feel you can look down on other Christians from your exalted position of spirituality. You're in a very dangerous condition if that's your status tonight. Of course, we must from time to time make judgments. We must sometimes form opinions, but it's the spirit of the thing. What's Paul's point here? What is God's view of power and status and weakness? Where is authentic Christianity actually put on display? Well, Paul says a lot here in a picture, and it's a picture that's studied through verse 9. I want to read it to you from a modern translation or paraphrase. If you look at verse 9 in your New King James version, he says, "It seems to me that God has put us apostles in the worst possible place. We are like prisoners on their way to death. Angels and the people of this world just laugh at us." Says in the New King James, "For I think that God has displayed us, the apostles, last as men condemned to death, for we have been made a spectacle to the world, both to angels and to men." And the word that is used there in the New King James version of spectacle, if you had a margin in your New King James, and there's one in this New King James, it says theatre. That's the Greek word, theatra. It's a Greek word that we translate theatre or spectacle. So the picture, here of a procession. And it's on its way to the theatre, not the nice thing with plush seats with the curtain that opens, but the Roman theatre, the amphitheatre, where there were these this great big circle of seats stacked up, these terraces of seats, and in the centre was this arena where the sports and the gladiatorial contest took place. Those of you who've seen the film Gladiator, that was the Colosseum. It was a theatre. It was a theatre in Rome. And the picture is of the procession of artists and athletes and soldiers who are entering the theatre, entering the amphitheatre in order to put on the day's game. That's the picture. And that's the picture running through verse 9. Those of you who travelled in those parts of Europe upon which the Roman civilization made such a huge impact will have seen some of those amphitheatres. They seem to be everywhere. Colin and I visited some during our holiday in southern Italy a few years ago. That's a particularly impressive one at Pompeii. And we found another one that was basically ignored. It was falling to rack and ruin. The local lads came with their cans of beer and their packets of crisps, and they had their snacks in this fantastic 2,000-year-old amphitheatre. They got this history coming out of their ears in Italy. And there's so much of it that they can't look after it properly. But here in Santa Maria Capua Vetere, or Italian, please forgive my pronunciation, was this fantastic amphitheatre. There were places for sport, for races, for wrestling, and so on. The games. And in some of these theatres, dreadful things occurred. There were gladiatorial contests, men killing each other for the entertainment of the masses. And on many of these occasions, society's undesirables, its criminals, its terrorists, they were stripped and they were made to fight with wild beasts to the death. And if they survived one day, they were put on display the next day. And the next day they would be invariably killed. Now these undesirables, these criminals and terrorists, when the procession entered the theatre in the morning, the celebrities went first, and then the animals, and then at the end, the undesirables who went to fight with the wild beasts, and people would throw rubbish at them, and filth, and excrement, and rotten fruit, and all that kind of, and hurl abuse at them. And here at the end were these undesirables. That's the picture. What are these people worth? What does the world think about them in these moments? What's their value? What's their significance? They're nobodies. They're heading for the jaws of a hunting dog, or to the paws of a lion, while the people howl with laughter, and delight, and clap and cheer, as they have their heads ripped off or their bowels spilled open. Horrible, horrible thing. And they were at the back of the queue. They were the last in the procession. Now, that's what Paul says in verse 9. I think that God has displayed us, the apostles, last as men condemned to death. For we have been made a theatre to the world. We are fools for Christ. We are weak. To this present hour, we are hungry. We thirst. We are poorly clothed. We are beaten. We are homeless. We work with our own hands. We are reviled. We are persecuted. We are defamed. We've been made as the filth of the world. I think that's the Apostle Paul. The greatest preacher, maybe, who's ever lived, apart from the Lord Jesus Christ. For the Corinthians had a view of the kingdom of Christ that made them think that they should have status and they should have importance, that they were health, wealth and happiness people. They felt that through their new teachers, these new leaders in the church, they felt that they could get into such lofty heights of spiritual excellence that they could look down upon the Apostle Paul and dismiss him as a nobody. Though his ministry had been authenticated by the Holy Spirit, though his gospel had resulted in dozens of conversions in Corinth, they could sit on their lofty thrones with their new spiritual celebrity and look down upon him. How does he defend himself? He says, if you want the truth, I'm actually like one of those criminals at the back of the procession. Who put us there? God put us there. I think that God has displayed us, the apostles, last as men condemned to death. We look like absolute fools in the world's eyes. Why? So that you Corinthians might come to know the wisdom of the gospel. We were made to suffer terrible weakness. Why? So that you Corinthians might know the power of God. We've been despised by the great ones of this world. Why? So that you Corinthians might receive the great honor of being brought into the kingdom of God. We endured nakedness and hunger and thirst and beatings. We worked hard in manual labor to make a living. We were reviled, we were defamed, we were treated as the filth of society. Why? So that you Corinthians might be blessed. Verse 13 is actually breathtaking. Here's someone in the kitchen and they're cooking something, and on the top of the casserole dish is a load of scum. It's fatty scum that they don't want to eat, so they skim it off and they throw it on the floor for the dogs to lick up. And Paul says, that was us. We are like the filth of the world, the off scouring. The things you scour off and then throw away as rubbish. So says Paul, this is my triumphal procession. Not like the Roman general Titus bearing the treasures of the temple in Jerusalem through the streets of Rome to the cheering crowds and the clapping and adoring women. No Regent Street crowds, no Oxford Street clapping, no celebrity welcome to Buckingham Palace, no little gin and tonics with Tony at number 10. My procession's more like the ones with the criminals at the back of the procession going into the amphitheatre, going to their death. The crowd will jeer, not cheer. They'll clap, not when I wave my regal hand at them, they'll cheer when my throat is ripped out by a hunting dog. That's my possession. That's where I belong. What does it matter? What Paul is saying here, my friends, is that he is willing to bear any suffering so that the gospel will come to others. He's willing to bear any suffering so that the gospel will come to others. One of the hardest things that the Christian church faces in this country is congregations that are half full of men and women who won't bear anything that the gospel might come to others. Won't serve in the youth work, won't do any door-to-door, won't come to a prayer meeting. They come once on a Sunday, that's the last you see of them. They don't, as far as you can tell, they don't want to suffer any inconvenience for the gospel. They want to receive the benefits of everybody else's ministry, but they themselves, they don't want to endure any pain, experience any inconvenience in order to serve the gospel. The kinds of Christians that God cheers, the kinds of Christians that God applauds, are those who are willing to bear any inconvenience that he sends their way, as long as they can serve the gospel and see that life and wisdom and joy and salvation come to others. Willing to experience loss in order for other people to know the gospel of Jesus Christ. Willing to live a lifestyle that the world outside thinks is stupidly unattractive so that Christ might be preached to the lost. One of my heroes in the faith, a man called Laurie Farley, who was an elder at the Chessington Evangelical Church, died a few years ago, introduced me to a massive book this thick, written by Paul Hathaway. It's a huge prayer manual for China. Laurie prayed through it every day. And it describes all the little people groups in China. Some of them only 2,000 strong, some of them 4,000 strong. I use it myself from time to time, not as often as he did. But I was praying once for the group called the Bugun people. There were only 4,000 of them in China. There isn't a single Christian amongst the Buguns, as far as we know. But in 1893, a lady doctor from America called Eleanor Chestnut went to their part of China to try and reach them. She was a surgeon, and she built the hospital from her own funds for the sick. But until this hospital was ready, she had to practice medicine in her kitchen, including operations. So one minute she'd be making the casserole, the next minute she'd be sawing the leg off. One patient had to have his leg amputated, and the flaps of flesh covering the stump refused to heal, and more surgery was required. Well, the surgery was given and the patient recovered. And after he'd recovered, it was noticed that Dr. Chestnut was limping because she had taken a skin graft from her own leg in order to restore the leg of this man who was a coolie, a slave. And her Chinese nurses were absolutely bewildered that she should do such a thing. A rich Western doctor should do such a thing for a good-for-nothing coolie. Now, where does that put the doctor? If a good-for-nothing coolie is at the bottom of the pile, where does that put the doctor? It puts her last in the procession. She's willing to give up all that life of ease and wealth in America to strip off her own skin from her own leg to heal the stump of a good-for-nothing slave. In 1905, she and four other missionaries were killed by a mob that stormed the hospital during the Boxer Rebellion. Do you know what that is? It's dying to self so that other people might live. It's being willing to be treated as the off-scouring of the world. These Boxer rebels They thought these Western missionaries were the filth of the earth, and they treated some of them like that. It's the gospel of the cross, really. It's the gospel of the Son of God who loved me and gave himself up to the cross for me. It's the gospel of the one who was willing to be jeered at and sneered at in naked humiliation in public, in order to open up the gates of heaven for sinners. The Almighty Son of God, the one who created the heavens and the earth, comes to hang naked. His procession through the streets of Jerusalem is the procession of the criminal, carrying his own cross in his weakness, having been beaten and whipped till the bones on his back showed through his flesh. He comes to the cross, he hangs there naked before the world with spit drying on his face in order to die so that you and I might find life. The Son of God was willing to be last in the procession for the gospel's sake. And the Apostle Paul was willing to be in the same position himself, to endure any hardship, any problem, any pain, any suffering, just so that the gospel might come to lost people. There were no scenes of stately majesty for Christ, no robes, no crowns except for thorns. It was a scene of sacrifice, but it was holy ground, because it was the place where the world's salvation was accomplished by a man willing to die so that others might live. Wouldn't it be wonderful if this was the spirit that pervaded every heart in this church? If this was our spirit, if this was our attitude to Christian service, if this spirit determined the way we used our money, if this spirit decided the way we used our time, if this spirit determined the way we treated one another, willing to put ourselves at the end of the procession and in order that others might be served. Converted in the boys' brigade. And not long after I became a Christian, we had a meeting in Oldham. I was a staff officer, non-commissioned officer, with my little stick, the silver thing on the end, in the 6th Oldham Company. And we were having a visit in Oldham from a very, very important man. Major General D.J. Wilson, not a disc jockey, mind. Major General D.J. Wilson Huffington, commander of the British Empire. So we boys, we went to hear. He gave a talk. He was a Christian man, famous soldier, well decorated, gave this marvelous talk on the gospel to us boys. And we all had a bit of tea, sandwiches, and plates, some paper plates, and all that. And then we all buzzed off. And as I was leaving, going out through the door, I looked back for one last glimpse of the great Major General. You know what he was doing? He was picking up the rubbish that we boys had left on the floor. Kind of thing you do when you're a celebrity, isn't it? Part of the spirit of Jesus Christ. Well, let's seek to ensure that the Corinthian spirit is driven from our hearts and from our church. And let's seek to ensure that each one of us, one by one, is willing to serve the Lord Jesus and his people and his world as those who are willing to accept the last place in the procession, even if it's inconvenient and painful, so that the gospel might proceed and bless. Let's sing together.